morning. We're delighted to welcome students today. We have students from Faith Christian School. Would they please stand?
Big group.
Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Randolph High School. Would you please stand? Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And under this program, which is a national award-winning program, students are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they are sent materials on the case that they will hear, and they may do some activities that are involved with the case. They come, listen to oral argument, and then at the end of the second oral argument this morning, the students will meet with a justice of this court that is assigned for that day, and the discussion will be on the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases, not on the substantive issues involved in the case. And everyone is welcome to come to that discussion afternoon. We have a summary of the case that you're about to hear. If anyone would like a summary, would you raise your hand? All right. Yeah. Thank you, Marshall. And there's a young woman in the back row. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He is the justice with whom you will meet today. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case for today, which is 09AP3029, Crown Castle USA versus Orion Logistics, LLC. Arguing for Orion Logistics is Nicholas Andrew Wagner. Mr. Wagner. Have I put enough syllables in your name?
I think that's about it. You got the E on the end of Wagoner, so that's usually a good start. Attorney Andrew Wagoner for Orion Logistics. Crown Castle obtained a default judgment against Orion Construction in 2005. As part of their attempt to collect against Orion Construction, they filed a foreign judgment in the state of Wisconsin. As part of the supplemental exam process under Wisconsin Statute 816, Crown Castle has attempted to expand the supplemental exam process into Orion Logistics. Orion Logistics was never part of the default judgment, was never a party of any action, and the sole basis for the circuit court in requiring or ordering Orion Logistics to go through the supplemental exam process is that Orion Construction and Orion Logistics have a common owner. Common owner is Mr. Larson. Orion Logistics argues essentially 5 points that does not allow the circuit court to expand the supplemental exam process into a separately protected business entity formed under Chapter 183 of Wisconsin statutes. Those 5 points are essentially, one, the specific statutory language in Wisconsin Statute 816.06 and Wisconsin Statute 03. Two, we believe that the cases used in the appeals court, Hellenbrau and Wisconsin Courtyard, the facts in those cases.
Is this your second point?
Third point.
So first is the statutory language, the second is the case law.
The second point is this. Those two cases, the factual cases, do not apply in a case when there's a separate legally recognized entity under 183. The third point is there are really other avenues available under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act for a third party to be reviewed or examined. In fact, if there was a fraudulent transfer from one business entity to the other. The fourth point is really as a policy point of view, how far do you go if you're looking at the common ownership of a business? How far do you go? Is it 100% ownership? Is it a half a share ownership, fractional shares? When does that line get cut off in order to expose the proprietary information of a business to being reviewed for collection of a debt against against another party? The fourth point, or the fifth point, I apologize, is that Circuit Court doesn't have jurisdictional grounds to order a a third party to comply to an order to reveal its proprietary information regarding its business or financial affairs.
As to your fifth ground, there's jurisdiction to do a supplemental, right? You don't have any problem about that.
No, there's definitely jurisdictional grounds. I mean, once a judgment is attained in Wisconsin, clearly any creditor can, pursuant to the 816, proceed a supplemental exam against that entity that has a judgment.
All right. And then is there any question about personal jurisdiction? Did they subpoena this corporation to come and testify?
Are you talking about Orion Logistics, the third party?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is, because Orion Logistics was never served a summons and complaint. They were never given...
No. But can't I be subpoenaed as a witness without a summons and complaint?
My position is no, because if you look at the discovery process and you look at the way the discovery process is outlined in Wisconsin, there's a third party, but once a judgment is entered, if you look at Wisconsin statute, the specific statute section says that a judgment is a determination of the action. So at that point, my reading is that discovery has ended in that case, in whatever case you're looking for. So what you're left with is then, once the judgment is attained, is the right of the judgment creditor to collect against the judgment debtor.
So the action, words make a difference. So a judgment is entered, and what's finished then?
The language in the statutes in Wisconsin state that once a judgment is entered, that is the determination of the action.
Okay. But we have here a proceeding, right, under the supplemental is considered a proceeding.
I would agree with
not
that.
Not an action.
Right. I would agree with
okay,
that.
Okay. So we have a proceeding here. So what moment is it that once a judgment is entered, the action is finished if our law provides for this proceeding?
Could you restate that question?
I'm not understanding why it's important that an underlying judgment was entered. It's not like the matter is signed, sealed, and delivered, because our law says, in 816, I think it is, that you have this supplemental, and it's referred to as a proceeding. That's why I say words matter. Some things are trials, some things sometimes are actions, sometimes things are called matters, sometimes things are called proceedings. This, a supplemental, is a proceeding, right?
It is a proceeding, but it is a proceeding authorized by the statutes in Wisconsin with specific rules of how those proceedings are to be governed.
And now we're back to your point one. That's what I'm trying to do, is get rid of point five or not get rid of it. And Justice Bradley's question is another way of saying the one I asked you, that is, there's jurisdiction because you have a proceeding, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, you call in somebody to testify, right? So what's the jurisdictional problem? If you've got, do you have jurisdiction over this corporation in Wisconsin?
Do we have jurisdiction on what?
This corporation in Wisconsin.
This Orion Logistics is a corporation formed under Chapter 183 of Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, yeah. So you have personal jurisdiction, you have subject matter jurisdiction. Now maybe you can quash all of this because you don't come under 816.
Excuse me, I guess I'm missing something. I know the Chief Justice asked you if Orion Logistics was subpoenaed for a supplemental proceeding. And I didn't know if you said yes or no. So if you could straighten that out, then I can understand the conversation better.
They were ordered to the subpoena part is really not, because when you talk to Mr. Larson, you're really talking to Orion Construction and Orion Logistics. So what was required is Orion Logistics was required to reveal its books and records, its financial affairs during the supplemental exam process.
By a court order that they weren't subpoenaed by anybody just for that company to appear.
Right. The court order required disclosure of their financial affairs.
Thank you very much. Then I understand better.
It seems to me the essence of the questions being asked is that in a supplementary proceeding, do the ordinary rules of discovery apply?
They do not, in my opinion. They do not.
Why?
Because the action is concluded. Discovery is used to be used during the course of a litigation. Interrogatories, admissions, subpoenas, third-party subpoena deuces tecums. And the reason why I believe there's a distinction, because if I'm involved in litigation, and I know somebody was involved in a transaction, a third party. They're not a party to the action, but I know they have information that I want. I'm either going to take their deposition under the deposition statute, or I'm going to require them to give me various documents. But under the discovery process, the scope or the amount of documents you're going to be able to obtain are going to be regulated. They're going to be controlled. I am not going to get a carte blanche review of some independent third party in the course of litigation to review all their financial information. It's going to be limited because there's going to be protective orders and stuff like that. In the supplemental exam process, those rules are gone, according to what happened to Orion Logistics in this case. Further, in discovery in the course of litigation, what happens is, as indicated, once the judgment is obtained, that action is done, and you can no longer, in my opinion, conduct discovery under the typical discovery statutes. You are now, under the statute structure in Wisconsin, required to follow the collection process or the collection statutes, which is 816, to collect against that judgment.
Well, let me ask this. In Pennsylvania, that lawsuit, could Mr. Larson have been deposed?
Mr. Larson would have been subject to all the discovery process in the Pennsylvania statute had he not defaulted, or Orion Construction not defaulted on the judgment.
How about Orion Logistics?
In this case, Orion Logistics, I believe, was formed prior to that lawsuit, but it was a different company doing different business. In that case, we were talking, it would have been a breach of contract requiring the construction of a cell tower in Illinois. There may have been some related, but again, the discovery process wouldn't have been into their financial affairs. It may have been I'm making a hypothetical, Justice Prosser, because I don't know the specific details, but really it would have been extremely limited because that company was not involved in the construction of the cell tower in Illinois.
Let me ask this. In the supplementary proceeding, your position would be that Orion Construction, the judgment debtor, has to answer all the questions. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And a corporation can't testify. I mean, maybe a corporation could provide records, but who gets to testify?
In the context of this case, it would have been Mr. Larson because he would have been the individual with the information regarding the financial information of Orion Construction to provide where the debts are. Maybe the accountant, a former accountant at that point in time, would be available. But anybody that would have information, I believe, on behalf of the company, is an employee of the company, would have been required to provide information regarding...
So the accountant for Orion Construction could have been called as a witness?
I would believe they would, because they are part of...
And any other employee?
Anybody that is an employee of Orion Construction, in my position, would have been able to have been called.
Let's suppose we had a person named Mary Smith. Hypothetically, Mary Smith worked for Orion Construction in 2006. And now Mary Smith works for Orion Logistics in 2011. May Mary Smith be called?
Yes.
Any limitations on the questions?
I think that Mary Smith would have been limited to what were the assets in Orion Construction and whether or not any assets were transferred from Orion Construction to Orion Logistics. I think that's a fair question at that point in time.
I want to turn to Statute 885, which is the general 885-01, which is the general subpoena statute for circuit courts and others. And it is unclear to me why this wouldn't, number one, apply, and number two, be dispositive of the case. So you've got to help me on this one. 885 allows for any judge or commissioner and others to issue a subpoena requiring the attendance of a witness, their production of lawful instruments, in any action, matter, or proceeding pending, or to be examined by the court or commissioner or any other person authorized to take testimony in the state. Why doesn't that apply to your case here?
Because I think that the proceeding in the process under 816 has specific statutory language limiting the examination to the judgment creditor. I think that is beyond, it's a more narrower view than what is available in the discovery process. There can be a proceeding, there can be proceedings that can involve ongoing discovery before you even get to some type of final order. That's what that statute applies to.
I need cases and I need citations to statutes, but people don't always have that. So then I listen to argument. But do you have any citations or cases that would indicate that 885, the general subpoena authority for courts and commissioners and proceedings, trials and actions?
None that I'm aware of here.
Okay. Is there anything in 816 that indicates it's the exclusive? It would be the exclusive authority, and I guess I'm talking about the 816.03 that generally deals with being compelled to answer questions and to appear. Anything that indicates in the statutes, because I haven't read all of the statutes all around.
It's really an undeveloped area of the law. It really is. From personal experience, I see the Wisconsin statute 816 being used in a variety of ways, and there's inconsistent results all the way around. I have argued that you can't look at the shareholder if you got a judgment creditor and have won that.
Mm-hmm. So you would be... Since in my reading of 885, the plain language would cover this because it's a proceeding and it gives court general authority, you would be suggesting that maybe we curb 885 as not to be applying to 816 proceedings. If you have 885, or if you're familiar with it. If you're not familiar with it, that's okay, too. If you can't answer, that's fine. Sometimes I can't answer.
I guess What it is Wisconsin statutes, the 816, 06, and 03, it's an examination. If you want to call it a proceeding, I guess you could do that. But it's really an examination of witnesses to determine whether or not there are assets to be collected against the judgment. That, to me, is distinctly different than having a proceeding to come to some final order or some final result. In the exam, you have a result.
Counsel, you know, proceeding is a noun here, and 816.03, if you look at sub 2, I think there are three different times in sub 2 that they call this a proceeding. Under a second execution shall judge before whom such proceedings are pending that the property levied on or granted will be sufficient to satisfy such judgment with costs, then the proceedings herein are provided. So I think this is a proceeding, sometimes a special proceeding, but I think this is called a proceeding, the 816 sort of stuff, in the legal, you know, nomenclature. Maybe. Okay. Let me change one final question, and that deals with your point 5, jurisdiction. You said there's no jurisdiction. Generally, I think of jurisdiction as being either subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction. Are you talking about either of those when you say there's no jurisdiction, or is there another kind of jurisdiction you're talking about?
No, those would be the two jurisdictions, subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction.
And which jurisdiction is lacking here?
Summons and complaint, personal jurisdiction.
Is the summons and complaint required under 816 to get personal jurisdiction?
I think that you have to have a summons and complaint to get a judgment.
Okay, thank you.
Now, the reason you don't have a subpoena in this case, I assume, is because you have an order under 816.035?
Correct.
Is that right? And the order was served on?
Orion Logistics.
And if I understand your argument, and who appeared on behalf of Orion Logistics? The corporation can't appear.
Mr. Larson.
Okay, appeared. All right. So the order was served as serve a summons on Orion Logistics. Now, it seems to me, if I understand your argument, that only the corporation against whom a judgment was entered can give testimony. Is that right?
Correct.
Right. And what exact language do you rely on?
03 and 06, I believe. Okay,
exactly. What exact language? Because your position is the only one that can be ordered to come to this supplemental proceeding.
It refers to judgment debtors. Language is used commonly in both. Judgment debtors.
Whether an individual orders such judgment debtor to appear, right?
Correct.
And the judgment debtor here was a different corporation and is appearing by Larson. Before the court or judge, an answer concerning the judgment debtor's property, right?
Correct.
So he answers about his property and the corporation and involves Orion Logistics, right? Says the money's gone, we got a different corporation.
Right.
And so you saying that the end, commissioner has no authority to go any further to find that money in another corporation or to ask questions about it. That's your position?
If you're looking for the fraudulent transfer of assets, any assets that would have been transferred between the two companies could have been asked through the Orion construction process. But to go through a full blanket scale review of every document, propriety information, no, the commissioner or the circuit court doesn't have authority to do that.
It may be that the order asked for too much and was too broad. But that, I don't understand that to be your argument. I understand your argument to be you bring in the judgment debtor, you ask the judgment debtor questions, but you can't test the judgment debtor's answers by bringing in somebody else.
In a third party, right.
A third party, that's right. So the judgment debtor says something that makes you believe that he's transferred lawfully or unlawfully, but that he's made a transfer of all of his assets to the ABC Charitable Foundation. And you say, well, you can't issue an order to the ABC company foundation to come in, right? I mean, that's your position.
Correct.
And so if it's a related corporation, which Larson totally owns, can't get that other corporation to come in.
Correct.
You're bound by the debtor's words.
You're bound by the debtor's words to reveal what happened to the assets or what is the nature of the assets within the debtor's entity, if you will.
But as I understand it here, Orion Construction is the judgment debtor.
That's correct.
But a corporation cannot testify. And so what I understood you to concede is that any present or former employee of Orion Construction could be called to testify about Orion Construction.
Right. I think that it's a business entity, so a fair investigation of the employees or the nature of the assets within Orion Construction is fair in a supplemental exam. And I also pose that that's sufficient to determine in that exam process whether fraudulent transfers have occurred. They get to review depreciation sheets or schedules of Orion Construction. They get to review the list of assets. If assets have disappeared, that's going to show up. That examination process is sufficient enough to determine whether or not a fraudulent transfer of assets has occurred or if they're a fair market value, and then whether they may potentially have a cause of action under the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. That examination process should disclose what they need to know to whether or not they need to argue whether or not a fraudulent transfer has occurred. And then if that's the case, then they need to plead that out and ensue litigation, which is really what happened in this case anyway, because there's another pending action so that we're defending. But that's the purpose. It's adequate to determine where the assets are and what they are. You don't need to have this. We get to go everywhere and anywhere of the judgment debtor and related business entities to determine what they have. And I see my red lights on, so I apologize.
Just want to turn before you sit down to 816.06. That's the one you've been relying on. The caption says examination of debtor and witnesses. So the caption there would lead you to believe that not only can the debtor be examined, but either side can bring in witnesses. Then it says, after hearing upon such order that we referred to already in 816.035, the judgment debtor may be examined on oath. And then it says, and testimony on the part of either party may be offered. It doesn't say testimony by the judgment debtor or by the judgment creditor. It says testimony on the part of, which makes me think that it relates to on behalf of, in favor of, or contrary to. And why isn't that broad enough to cover the corporation here?
My interpretation of the by either party language was limited to either the judgment creditor or the judgment debtor.
Yep, it doesn't quite say that.
No, I think there's some implicit meaning to that, but in the narrow scope of this, that's my take on it.
A counselor with a corporation, someone always has to testify on behalf of the corporation, right? So Mr. Larson would testify on behalf of Orion Construction, correct?
Right. There's a fiction. I mean, there's a fiction involved with corporations, absolutely.
But not all these cases involve corporations. Well, the next time you're up, if you've looked at the legislative history of that, perhaps we can talk about that.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Attorney, is it, how do you pronounce your name? Monk? Nathan Monk, representing Crown Castle USA. Mr. Monk.
May it please the court. My name is Nathan Monk. I'm an attorney with Michael Best and Friedrich, and I represent the respondents, who I will refer to collectively as Crown Castle. In a unanimous decision, the Court of Appeals correctly ruled that the Circuit Court had the authority to order Orion Logistics to submit to a supplemental examination within a proceeding under Chapter 816 of the Wisconsin statutes. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals for at least two reasons. First, while specific sections within Chapter 816 may be ambiguous, after a review of Chapter 816 as a whole, related statutes on discovery, and predecessor versions of Chapter 816, it's clear that Chapter 816 provides the Circuit Court and Court Commissioners the authority to expand the scope of a supplemental examination to include a third party.
Counselor, isn't this a statutory right that didn't exist at common law?
I understand. I believe it was 1847. This was not. However, that was when courts of equity and law were divided. A party would sue in a court of law, obtain a money judgment, and I believe a court of equity in that situation would then have a creditor's bill or a right to proceed in something similar to something as a supplemental proceeding as we know it today.
But the right that you are operating under today is a statutory right, correct?
It is. That is correct.
And with a statutory right, you are limited by the terms of the statute, correct?
That is correct.
In 816.03, I haven't found any place where it says a court can order anyone but a judgment debtor to appear. Is there something I've missed?
I believe there is, Your Honor.
Okay. And would you point that out? That would be great help.
A brief understanding of Chapter 816, I think, sets the stage exactly for how Chapter 816 operates. As this case does turn on an interpretation of Chapter 816, which applies when a party has a money judgment, in this case a $500,000 money judgment. At its core, this case is about whether Wisconsin law, under the statutes, provides a judgment creditor the necessary tools to collect a money judgment. And Chapter 816 allows a judgment debtor to initiate a supplemental examination, and this is done under 816.031 A and B, which are the initiation sections.
Okay, just stop right there. Now, where in A and B does it say that the court can order anyone other than a judgment debtor to appear?
A and B, it doesn't say that. Specifically, the initiation of a supplemental proceeding is limited, or the terms provide the judgment debtor. When you look to Section 816.06, this identifies who may be called, a separate section expanding, or at least interpreting exactly what Chapter 816 as a whole provides for.
Where does it say in 816.06 that the court can order anyone other than the judgment debtor to appear?
Start with the statutory language. It's entitled Examination of Debtor and Witnesses.
That's a caption, and we have case law that says captions aren't part of the statute.
Captions are not part of the statute. However, they may be looked to interpret the words or the meaning of the text of the statute. And the text provides, at the hearing upon such order or warrant, such judgment debtor may be examined on oath, and it continues, and testimony on the part of either party may be offered. These words must mean something. They can't be read out of the statute.
Well, I don't know that they're ever read out of the statute, Counselor, but we have a corporation that's a judgment debtor here, and you're always going to have somebody else speaking on behalf of the judgment debtor because corporations can't legally speak in this kind of a proceeding, correct?
For a corporation, that's exactly correct.
Okay. So, I mean, the statute is covering corporations as well as individual persons, correct?
And third parties, which
Where do you get the third party? It says on behalf of either party. To me, that's a defendant and a plaintiff.
It isn't, Your Honor.
Why?
If you specifically look, starting with the chapter as a whole, 816.11 provides. It's entitled Costs and Fees. It says the court or judge may allow the judgment creditor, and it continues, or to any party so examined, whether a party to the action or not, witness fees and disbursements in a fixed sum in addition, not exceeding $25. I submit that Section 816.06 is ambiguous. Looking at the chapter as a whole to interpret the statute, however, 816.11 is a starting point which provides clearly that a third party who's not a party to this action could be called under Chapter 816.
All right. I see what you're pointing out. Thank you.
Wait. You're saying that party in 816.11 includes witnesses?
I don't understand your question, Justice Prosser.
Party, there's a plaintiff, there's a defendant, there could be an intervener. But, I mean, are you saying that this word party here applies to everybody who's subpoenaed as a witness?
That's what he's saying.
I am, Justice Prosser. Under 816, it says, costs and fees may be allowed to any party so examined, comma, whether a party to the action or not, which clearly would mean someone other than a plaintiff or defendant if they're not a party to the action.
You're talking about the first action in Pennsylvania here?
Definitely not. The action in Pennsylvania was taken by default. That was then docketed here in Wisconsin, starting a supplemental proceeding. Whether it's a special proceeding is how I would characterize that. And then if we also...
Is it your position that any witness who is subpoenaed under 816.06 can be compelled to divulge proprietary information about their property, their income, their debts?
It most certainly is.
In exactly the same way as the judgment debtor?
The purpose of Chapter 816 is a discovery proceeding. I would imagine the examination of a judgment debtor likely would be broader. If there's circumstances where there's a fraudulent transfer, it could be limited to certain transfers. However, the facts of each matter would determine exactly how broad that would be. And under Chapter 885.01, as well as 805.07, specifically dealing with third-party subpoenas, both of those either supplement or help interpret when read together to harmonize Chapter 816 exactly the scope and how far you may go. And specifically, 805.07 references the protective order statute. So there are plenty of protections available if a proposed order is overly broad and unduly burdensome. There are a limitless number of protections that circuit courts could exercise to determine that it doesn't go too far and that a motion to quash an order, for example, could be a route to follow.
Counsel, you referenced 885. Can a subpoena be issued under 885 in this proceeding?
Yes, it can.
What authority do you have for that?
The specific language at 885.01, I understand, extends to actions or proceedings. And 801.01, I understand, provides that there's two types of act, or a proceeding is divided into an action or a special proceeding. And 816 clearly would fall under the provisions of 885.01. And specifically, if you look at section 805.07, dealing with third-party subpoenas, that again clearly provides that a third-party subpoena power extends to actions and special proceedings.
Counselor, what you're changing 816 into then is just a continuation of discovery from the action on which you received judgment in Pennsylvania.
I don't think it's changing anything. What we have is a judgment, and 816 is a discovery proceeding allowing a judgment creditor. Liability has already been determined. It's not extending it. It's allowing the judgment creditor the tools necessary to find exactly where the money may have gone.
Why isn't it an extension of the discovery that could have gone on in the proceeding in Pennsylvania?
The proceeding in Pennsylvania was a breach of contract action. There wasn't any allegations of fraudulent transfer, piercing the corporate veil, successor liability, basic fraud. At that point in time, it wasn't known what assets Orion Construction Group may have had. It's only upon the implementation of the supplemental proceeding did we find out in Wisconsin that assets have been transferred. So at that point in time, the purpose of the discovery is to find out where those assets have gone. It's not an extension insofar as it's trying to find out exactly whether a breach of contract may have occurred.
Counselor, my understanding from the materials that have been provided to us is that you have started an action for fraudulent transfer.
That is correct.
Why isn't that the appropriate place to carry on discovery of this type rather than broadening how 816 has been used in the past?
There's a number of issues. One would be the statute of limitations will continue to run. For example, if you're under Chapter 242 for a fraud action, there's, I believe, separate statute of limitations. One is 4 years, and I believe one is upon discovery. This judgment was entered in Wisconsin in 2007, I believe. We're in 2011 right now. This provides that would provide the judgment creditor the ability to drag its feet, show up at a supplemental examination, say I have no books, records, or assets, and simply say take it or leave it. And the take it or leave it may include filing a lawsuit. However, if you have a fraud action, for example, you have to plead with particularity, which could be a problem if you have a lot of facts that add up.
But you've already filed your action. I assume you know enough, as you said, to plead with particularity, so you must have done that.
In this case, we most definitely do. There are other circumstances where a party may just show up and say, I don't have anything, I'm sorry, I had a couple million dollars, for example, if there is a lending relationship. My personal financial statement says I have $15 million in assets a year ago. I have nothing now. There may be discovery or some other facts suggesting that it could have been transferred. And as attorneys, we do have an obligation to conduct as much discovery as possible before filing a lawsuit.
What if you had Ford Motor Company here as a related corporation and there was a solely owned subsidiary that you had a judgment against? Think you can bring Ford Motor Company into this supplemental proceeding and ask them about all of their assets and were any of them transferred from the solely owned subsidiary?
If the facts warranted, most definitely, whether under Chapter 885.01, 805.07, as interpreted and brought into a special proceeding under Chapter 816, I'm sure Ford Motor Company would show up and either try to quash that subpoena and argue how the information sought isn't relevant.
Right, but there wasn't a subpoena here. There was a court order, so there wasn't an ability really to quash it. You're dealing with a different animal.
There most certainly was. An order was issued upon Mr. Larson by the court or his counsel, and in that proceeding, there was a response brief. This issue was completely briefed in the trial court. We filed an opening brief specifically to expand the scope of jurisdiction. Orion Logistics filed a response brief. They filed a letter sur reply brief. They also filed a motion to reconsideration. This issue was fully heard and argued in the trial court.
Okay, so it wasn't in the course of a quash motion, but rather in the course of developing the order that stands before us now.
I believe that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
I'm going to ask maybe the same question Justice Rogensack did, but slightly differently. Why isn't this case moot now? Because you can get all your discovery there. And then, no matter what you get in discovery in this proceeding, you still cannot get at the assets in this proceeding, can you?
As to your first question, this isn't moot because while the lawsuit is pending, we still haven't received the documents. There's any number of procedural mechanisms or unknowns in civil litigation that could occur. And your second question?
My second question is, even when you get the documents and you have reason to believe that there's been a fraudulent conveyance, don't you have to bring another proceeding in order to get at those assets?
A proceeding does have to be brought. The purpose of this discovery, though, is more of an efficiency mechanism. It allows a party to go out and find out if a fraudulent transfer did occur, who to sue, and how to plead that with as much particularity as possible.
I'm just making an assumption that it's from that time on discovery that you would urge your statute of limitations to begin to run on the fraudulent transfer.
I believe so. I'd also like to briefly address.
Mr. Monk, I give you a lot of credit for staking out a position, holding to it, and it's as clear as a bell. The implication of what you're saying, though, is that judges and litigants for many years really didn't know what the heck they were doing. And for example, in courtyard condominiums, a spouse had to give evidence. But the court said, but we're talking about marital property here. And that sort of takes us out of the normal realm of things. The Court of Appeals, in this case, talked about, well, that Douglas Larson owns Orion Construction. He's the sole owner. And he's the sole owner of Orion Logistics. So that's sort of an exception here. Or that's why we get to do this. You're saying this is nonsense. Anybody is a witness. Anybody has to come in and give everything that they have unless they get a protective order. And so the decades of law were just, we didn't quite understand it.
I don't believe that there's decades or any law that's addressed the question of whether a party under 885.01 or 805.07 could do so. It simply hasn't been addressed. The Courtyard case did have a fairly narrow ruling saying specifically regard to marital property as you address section 765.55 as well as 803.045 allowed for the extension in that circumstance. That was perfectly fine. That's exactly what was needed to find out what marital property may be available and based on the facts of those cases to satisfy that judgment. The lower court in this case undertook a similar analysis. They compared it to Chapter 242, which is the same exact analysis under 242, which applies to a debt and specifically relates to the collection of a debt. The lower court said in that case, just like marital property, a party as well can go after that fraudulent transfer and extended it on those grounds alone. I wholeheartedly agree that those cases are correct. What they did not do was address these separate sections.
Counsel, this case involves a close to $500,000 debt, and you have been retained and you started another lawsuit also regarding fraudulent conveyance, just in case this one isn't playing out in your favor, or perhaps you started it for other reasons, but it looks to me like you're building on it. At any rate, and you can likely get some of this information in your fraudulent conveyance separate lawsuit. I want to know how this plays out, not for Ford Motor Company, not for the parties here, for Orion Logistics or Orion Construction. How does this play out in what you are advancing for the electrician in Main Street in Westby, Wisconsin, who has a judgment against a home builder for $27,000, and he's concerned that money is being hidden from him? How does it play out in Winneconne, Wisconsin, where you have a judgment, someone has a judgment in the amount of $15,000, and maybe they can't even hire lawyers, but they think that money is being hidden from them. Tell me how your arguments play out for them.
I think it would play out exactly how it's played out, as I've argued throughout the course of this argument today, specifically how it would apply in a civil lawsuit. There's third-party subpoenas issued all the time to perhaps a party that maybe can't afford an attorney, and it works, and it has worked for years, where that party can either object, raise the objection, but to back up, to actually go forward and try to look into different books and records. But
my concern is I don't necessarily want these bread-and-butter examples to have to start a separate fraudulent conveyance lawsuit to get this information. Is that the only way they would be able to get it if they couldn't get it through 816?
Through an action itself?
Yes, just to try to, you know, if they knew that some money was being hidden, the electrician in Westby knew that the home builder that he had a judgment against was really hiding money someplace. Is the only way that he could really get that, if he couldn't get it under 816, to start a separate fraudulent conveyance lawsuit?
If this court were to hold that a judgment creditor can only examine a judgment debtor, and you can't do so whether incorporating in 885.01 and 805.07, I believe that would be the only grounds to do so. For example, the judgment debtor could show up and either plead ignorance or flat-out lie about what had happened. The judgment creditor would have to throw its hands up and say, I can't do anything else except attempt to file a lawsuit if I know who that property was transferred to. I may not. I may have to try to get books and records from a bank, for example, look at a canceled check to see who that party was.
Well, go ahead.
How do you think 816.08 applies here, then?
816.08, I believe, deals with the appointment of a receiver, if I'm correct.
No, that's 04.
816.08. The property to be applied to the judgment?
H1608, I believe, the first sentence specifically says that if there is property that isn't owned or there's not a dispute as to who owns it, that can be taken and applied to the judgment. That's when you have the property and know where it's at. I believe this section continues that saying if there is a dispute between property, that a receiver could be appointed to determine that dispute. Chapter 816 on its face is a discovery statute. If there is a dispute between two parties as to who owns that property, a lawsuit would have to be initiated, if I understand your question correctly.
You could also garnish the person that you think the property was transferred to, just like you would on any judgment debtor, and then they could object and say they don't have property of the judgment debtor or provide it.
I believe a garnishment could work if you know who it is, and under a garnishment situation, I believe the person garnished has an obligation or a right to pay that to another party. There, again, isn't a dispute as to ownership or who owns that property. It's just a wage garnishment, for example, or if there's a payment under a contract, there isn't a dispute. You just go and serve those garnishment papers, and they pay it over to the judgment creditor as opposed
right.
to the judgment
but
debtor.
But you do obtain jurisdiction over the person that you're alleging has the property. And,
yes.
Of course, your statement is if you know they have it, but you're going to have to ask the judgment debtor anyway to find out if they have it. Here you've got a knowledge of corporations that are obviously linked through one man who is the sole owner of both. But our interpretation of this statute will not apply just to this kind of a very limited circumstance. It will apply to Ford Motor Company and a subsidiary or ABC Corporation that isn't owned at all or controlled at all in any way by DEF Corporation.
I understand that, and I do believe that's the proper interpretation of the law.
Wow. Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Counsel?
I would like to continue with a few other points, starting specifically with the language to the statute as it stood in 1935. 1935, the statute was number 273.06, entitled Examination of Debtor and Witnesses, much as it is today, but also contains the word reference. The text provides, upon his appearing or being brought before the judge, such judgment debtor may be examined on oath, and witnesses may be required to appear and testify on the part of either party in the same manner as upon the trial of an issue. It continues, the judge, in his discretion, may appoint a referee to take and report such examination and require the judgment debtor and witnesses, or any of them, to attend and be examined before him. In the brief to the Court of Appeals, as well as the petition to this court, it was argued that by amendments in 1935, that language was removed, seemingly removing the power to call third parties to testify. I wanted to draw to the court's attention the preamble to the amendments specifically stated that the purpose of the act was for clarity and conciseness of language and simplifying and improving said proceedings and for harmonizing the substantive provisions with the procedural rules which are being revised by the Supreme Court. At that time, there was no intent or any indication that the purpose of the amendment in 1935 was to remove that power that clearly was there at the time. It was simply to clarify and harmonize the statutes with other provisions, which clearly would have included Section 885.01 and perhaps other statutes at that time allowing a third-party witness to be brought in.
Counselor, just so I'm sure I understand you, the breadth that you see we should ascribe to Chapter 16 applies really to any corporation or individual that you think might have some information that could relate to the judgment debtor's property. Is that, am I right?
Most definitely. Okay. To give the remedy sought under Chapter 816, this court in 1885 even specifically noted that a judgment debtor, when called to testify, he will always give his testimony reluctantly. The court continued that an artful debtor will try to defeat the discovery sought. It even went on to say, if this happened, it will greatly impair the efficiency and usefulness of the remedy intended to be provided by Chapter 816. So most definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm a little concerned about my privacy. So there's something that leads Crown Castle USA, Inc. to think that I have assets of Orion Logistics. Maybe I owe them a huge amount of money. And our deal is it's not going to show on their books, and I'm not going to pay as long as there's this outstanding problem. When it's over, I'm going to pay. So can you haul me in as a citizen? And that's what you think. Of course, I'm clean as a whistle. I have nothing to do with any of this. They've got the wrong Shirley Abrahams. And you haul me in on a subpoena and say, okay, show me your balance sheet and your profit and loss statement and what your debts are and et cetera, et cetera. And I say, come on, I have some privacy.
If you showed
up.
And
as a public official, I have some privacy.
If you showed up and raised that objection under the protective order statutes, there clearly is a way to do so. If there are facts and information, though, showing that you, the Chief Justice, specifically may have received property and it's the right person, there is even the ability to have the court enter a protective order saying the information can't be disclosed beyond perhaps the attorneys if it were extended to attorneys' eyes only. It all starts with what facts and information are available to show. There may be information likely to lead to discoverable information relating to where property may exist. And under Chapter 816, if there isn't the power to go and find that information, judgment creditor simply may have to throw up his hands and say, you owe me $500,000, but there's nothing more I can do. I noticed
your, your view is that the 1935 statute, which changed the language, omitted you could call witnesses, didn't change anything.
It changed the language. It did not change anything, in part because of the language that was left in, the word witnesses in the title, as well as the final clause in the sentence clearly indicates the ability of a judgment creditor still to go after it when read in conjunction with Chapter 816.11, as well as 885.01 and 805.07. My time is about out. I'd like to make
one other question. There was a 1939 Marquette Law Review, which would have come after the 1935 changes. Now, I haven't read this. Is your view going to be reflected in that law review article on supplementary proceedings in Wisconsin?
I have read the article. I'm not sure if the point I'm raising right now is raised in that article. I do understand that article was cited in the brief to this court. I believe it does cite to a Supreme Court opinion from 1886, the Blabin v. Gilchrist case. I believe that's cited in there, and I believe that case doesn't apply to these facts whatsoever for three set reasons. First of all, that case specifically addressed Section 3030 as it existed in 1887. Section 3030, if you look at it carefully and compare it to the statutes as they exist today, is similar to 816.03 regarding who can initiate a supplemental proceeding. However, if you read the entire statute, the entire chapter as it existed in 1878, Section 3033 is exactly the same as Section 273.06, providing the ability to depose in third parties. So the court in that case had a very, very narrow holding and specifically looked only to 3030 and not to the statutes as a whole. And second, that case didn't deal specifically with fraudulently transferred property, as we have here. It dealt specifically with someone wanting to call a spouse generally to testify. And the court even noted at the end that the judgment creditor could have called a third party in that case. The court said that the judgment creditor had the right to examine the husband as to any matters he had transacted as agent for his wife, and perhaps might have been allowed to show that he had, as her agent, her property in his possession. So that case, which was cited in the brief to this court, has no application to this case. And for a third reason, the court in Blavin specifically addressed the power of a court commissioner to expand the case. This case deals only with the power of a court to expand the case. If the court has no further questions, I'll conclude by noting that when reviewing Chapter 816 as a whole, related statutes on discovery, and the prior versions to Chapter 816, it is clear that a circuit court and court commissioner have the authority to expand the scope of the supplemental examination to include a third party. This authority was recognized over a century ago by the court in Heilbronner and reaffirmed a decade ago by the Court of Appeals in Courtyard. Because the circuit court had such authority, this court should affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals expanding the scope of the supplemental examination to include Orion Logistics.
You think we should rely on Chapter 242 and use the analogy of courtyard case in terms of the analogy being the husband-wife, or just say, hey, it's there?
The facts of the case were limited by the Court of Appeals to Chapter 242, which I believe was clearly correct under the courtyard analysis. I've argued today that it is broader. Perhaps that's not the issue before this court, but it does support the fact that the court in this case did have the authority to do so.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Attorney Wagner, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I guess I'd like to conclude my argument by really making the argument that as a policy on business owners are individual entities, that to expand the scope of a preliminary exam to the breadth that they are requesting has the potential for abuse in the system. And there needs to be some protection available to third parties from being at the scope of this examination. For instance, in the other lawsuit, we were required to provide documents. We had to provide 30 boxes of documents in order to meet what their requirement was. So what you're really requesting when you start going into third parties to determine whether or not fraudulent assets were transferred, you're placing a heavy burden on them, whether you're small or large, to comply with the discovery request. And on top of that, we're asking that they reveal proprietary information. There could be competitors involved, and they might get access to competitive customers, competitive marketing. All that stuff is in place. A protective order isn't going to be adequate to protect against those types of disclosures. So I think as a policy matter, this state and in my experience of how I've argued these in other matters, and I have another matter going on that is even related to this issue as we speak, is that there needs to be some limit to the scope of examination when it comes to third parties. It is very necessary, as the way the law exists in this state, to have some type of control and limits into third parties and the type of information that they're going to have to reveal and expose.
Counsel, is the only way for a business owner then to get this information to file a separate fraudulent conveyance lawsuit, which requires, of course, pleading with particularity? Is that the only way, or are there other ways post-judgment that you can get information regarding what you think is a fraudulent conveyance, if not under 816?
I believe that the supplemental exam process, in most cases, should provide sufficient information to determine whether or not assets were transferred fraudulently or for less than fair market value. That information will be reviewed in the information against the judgment debtor. That is sufficient. In the event that the discovery has disclosed in that supplemental process that assets are not accounted for or not transferred for, then they can have the right to do a fraudulent transfer. That is a happy medium. It provides the third party with protection. It provides them with the constitutional right of due process and have the right to determine whether that transfer is pursuant to a jury. A jury can make that determination. The way it exists now, none of this transfer, if there is a fraudulent transfer, has the right to be reviewed by anybody during the process. It's just automatic, and that's why...
Discovery, yeah.
Right.
What about my concern with 885? Do you have to write anything into 885? Because this clearly is a proceeding, and it looks to me like the plain language of 885 covers proceedings.
I would agree with Justice Bradley that there is an issue with there, but I'm going to hold to what I've been arguing along in that the supplemental exam process is a narrower proceeding regulated by 816.
I mean, we've got lots of separate proceedings. I think of a John Doe as a proceeding. And so I'm just wondering if we're going to narrow 885, how that affects different kinds of proceedings.
Not necessarily. It could be narrowing, but I think we're providing more of a definition of what type of proceeding or whether or not this the supplemental exam proceeding is limited based on where it is in the suit or the proceeding or whatever you want to call it, that once you get to a judgment, then the ability to pursue that is narrower.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Wagner? Do you have any other comments you'd like to make, sir?
I have no further comments.
Thank you very much. I want to thank you, Mr. Wagner, and you, Mr. Monk, for your arguments today in an area we don't get too many cases on, namely supplementary proceedings. So thank you. That concludes our hearing in 09-AP-3029, Crown Castle USA versus Orion Logistics LLC. The court will take a short break, a brief break, so that those who wish to leave may do so, and that if there are any other people who wish to enter may also do that. Court's in recess.